All right. And thank you to Sangha Live for hosting me again. And I thank all of you for joining today from all the many places you're coming from. I'm Lama Rod. I use he, him pronouns. And I am living and teaching on my ancestral land here in the southern United States on Muscogee Creek Cherokee land that we now call Atlanta, Georgia. And shout out to all of the fellow folks here from Atlanta who are also tuning in. And I th again, welcome everyone into this talk today, into this time. I was just thinking, and as I was preparing to come on, how in many parts of the world we're entering into springtime, and here on this land, spring is very, it's very real. It's here. Trees are blooming and budding, flowers are coming up, grass is growing, it's warmer. There's an awakening of the land happening. And that's usually how it always goes. There's winter. And winter is a season of hibernation, of shutting down, of resting, of drawing inward. And then when we begin to enter into spring, the spring is the awakening. It's the gradual reorientation to life, to movement. It's the orientation to ecology and how there are relationships within an ecosystem. There's a remembering of that, right? And spring awakens, and this energy also is resummoned back into the world. This dynamic awakened energy. My practice, I call it the energy of the goddess, the energy of the mother, the energy of nurturing the expression of new life. And these are the patterns that are present in nature. When we talk about indigeneity and remembering the land and the caretakers of the land and the original stewards and communities of the lands that we are occupying now, it's important that we take a step further and to understand that there has been a crucial relationship to the land and the environment that has been lost for many of us, depending on where we are in the world. But I think about here in the United States, that there is a critical relationship to the land that has been lost because of the violence of colonization and settling. The ways in which the indigenous communities, from which I'm also descended from as well, held to the sacred relationship to the land. And as colonization happened and genocide happened, that relationship was disrupted. And what we're trying to do in our remembrance of indigenous land is to return back into indigenous relationship with the land. But we can't return back to this indigenous relationship to the land until we do the work of returning back to our bodies. Our bodies are expressions of the land. The land is expression of our bodies, right? So to experience a connection, awareness of the body or a relationship with the body is to also beginning to experience a relationship to the land under us. Because what we begin to understand, that's not so, this isn't so apparent in Buddha Dharma and Buddhism, but it's very apparent in indigenous practice, which is that the land is conscious, is sentient, right? The earth, the land is alive. And to understand the land, the earth, we have to do this incredible work to understand our bodies, because our bodies, again, are expressions of this grounded, earth-based consciousness. To say that the world is alive is another deeper expression of this indigenous wisdom. The world is alive. Phenomenal reality is alive. And what does that mean for you? To say something's alive, to say that something's conscious, that the world and phenomenal reality isn't just something for us to notice, right, and name and to hold space for, but the phenomenal world is there for us to understand our relationship to it, and for the phenomenal world to be in relationship to us. And for that relationship to happen, in general, it's about our willingness to experience the phenomenal world, not just think about it, not just proselytize, not just intellectualize, right? But to feel. I think intellectualization and analyzing and thinking and processing and reflecting, and that work is really important, absolutely. It's really important that we do that work in our practice, in our Dharma practice, but that's not the work that's actually going to get us free. We can't intellectualize our way to ultimate liberation. Right? When I talk about ultimate liberation, I'm talking about the realization of the illusion of everything, including ego and self, the illusion of everything. To transcend the binary of extremism, to come into the middle, and to understand the total truth of everything together. Right? That experience, right? And yes, the intellectual work helps us to move deeper into the experience, but it's us doing the gritty work of experiencing, of feeling into, of noticing where energy arises for us and being with that energy, stepping into that energy. That's how we begin to embody liberation. So when we talk about the phenomenal world, what I'm talking about, again, it's not just thinking about the phenomenal world or noticing the phenomenal world, but I'm also saying I'm interested in experiencing the phenomenal world. Everything can be experienced. A chair can be experienced. A cloud can be experienced. Sunshine can be experienced. Heartbreak can be experienced. Violence can be experienced. The earth under us can be experienced and has to be experienced. All the elements have to be experienced. The wind, fire, air, spirit, earth. The phenomenal world is full of data. But we block ourselves away from that data. Because the data is, well, on one hand, it may be too much for us to experience, or we believe that it's too much for us to experience, or we may not believe that the data is important to begin with. And the ways in which we believe that the data that the natural conscious world has for us, the way that we believe that that has nothing to do with us or that it's not important, is this further expression of systems of violence, like patriarchy, you know, white supremacy. As part of the colonialist kind of construct, you know, that the phenomenal world isn't really important. The only reason the phenomenal world is important because the phenomenal world is something that can be dominated, that can be engaged, and changed, manipulated, used for the welfare and benefit of the one who is dominating it. What we're, again, trying to do is cut through that tendency to dominate everything, including our bodies, including our minds, and to learn to be in an experiential relationship with everything. Not to dominate, not to use, not to manipulate, not to try to get past, right? Not trying to erase, but to experience. What does this feel like? And that data that we begin to become aware of actually begins to form a mirror for us. And that mirror begins to reflect back to us the work that we need to do to get free. And often this work is about the cultivation of love, compassion, equanimity. I know many of you, you know, you're in the, you know, you do practice, you go to your sanghas, you know, and you've read your books, you have your teachers. So you're familiar with this, you know, these four boundless qualities, the Brahma Viharas, right? You know, kindness and love and everything else. I always add many more Brahma Viharas to the four. I don't do well with lists. But we're familiar with qualities like love and compassion, right? But it's different when we develop an authentic relationship to the phenomenal world, the totality of the phenomenal world, both the good and the bad. And we're not bypassing anything. We're not even bypassing our own trauma. That everything is being experienced, and how that experience of everything becomes a mirror that shows us what work we need to be doing and continuing with. This is the hardest part of the work of Dharma and getting free, is that everything must be experienced. Because really, we understand the teachings is that the nature of everything is emptiness, is space. We can't get to that fundamental expression of everything until we experience everything. It's like we have to walk through the maze and wander through the maze to get to the center of the maze. Like we just can't fly over it, right? And land in the middle, we have to go through it. And this is all so exhausting to do. And I want you to take a moment to just acknowledge how hard it is to do the work of getting free. To acknowledge sometimes the hopelessness that we experience when we talk about enlightenment and how far enlightenment seems away from us, or how far it seems down the road. And we say, I'm so tired. It's okay. It's okay to admit that you're tired. It's okay to admit that you're overwhelmed. It's okay that to admit that you just don't give a shit sometimes. What does that acknowledgement feel like for you? Just to offer yourself the grace. You know, when I say grace, I mean the permission, the space, the freedom to name what you're experiencing in this moment. This naming is a truth telling. This is how we cultivate the truth telling, the clarity for us in our personal practice. We just begin, we say, okay, this is how I'm feeling, this is what's going on. And I know everyone, you know, everyone's really, you know, everyone loves for me to talk about justice and everything, you know, and justice, you know, we can talk about justice all day long, you know, but justice begins with this practice of naming what my experience is. I make an assumption that you also have been survivors of violence by people, beings who themselves did not have the capacity to know and name how they were feeling, let alone experience it. So they reacted to it. And in that reactivity, they created harm for us. They hurt us. The inner work of justice begins with telling the truth. It's also about telling the really, really, really hard truths. You know, to begin to acknowledge that, oh, yes, I do have these thoughts and beliefs, you know, that reveal how I participate in systems of violence and discrimination, prejudice. Yes, I have assumptions and attitudes about people who are different than me. Yes, I have, you know, we can see anti-black or anti-Asian sentiments, expressions in our experience. And we can see it, we can name it. When we begin to experience it, it becomes a whole other thing because there's the shame, there's the regret, there's the confusion, the hurt, the brokenheartedness. Sometimes, often actually, it's not about my hate or my aversion or my assumptions about other people and who they are and their lifestyle and their beliefs. Sometimes it's not about that. It's actually often about the ways in which we feel deeply hurt and insecure and not taken care of. The ways in which there have been hurts and woundedness that have not been tended to, and they create these patterns of thinking and behaving that potentially blame other people, you know, where we begin to blame other people for the hurts. We had nothing to do with the hurt. Naming that, naming how you enjoy occupying identity locations and positions of power. Because who wants to be weak? Who wants to be victimized? Who wants to be in a targeted, marginalized group? Why can't you name that? Because if you can't name it, you're not going to do the work of experiencing. Now, when I talk about experiencing, I often have a synonym for experience in my practice. Of course, that word is consuming. Consuming. When I experience something, when I choose to experience both my joy and the pain, I am consuming the experience. I am practicing a level of agency and power in the moment. And I'm choosing to be in relationship to something. And I'm choosing to be really curious about that thing. When I get curious about it, I am also opening to exploring the energy of that thing. How that energy shows up in my body and my mind. In the space around me, I become empathic in relationship to that experience. I begin to feel that experience. And this is where the earth comes back into play, because the earth becomes a source of refuge for us. The earth becomes a support. So when I am experiencing things that I struggle to experience, that I don't want to experience, I actually call the earth as this energetic, conscious refuge to be present. And I feel as if I'm being held by the earth. I feel as if I'm being supported by the earth, because you can't do this intense, deep internal experiencing without feeling connected to something that's supporting you, without feeling connected to benefactors around you who love you, who are taking care of you. So even just noticing the weight of our bodies making contact with our seat is the beginning of relying on the earth. It becomes an anchor. The earth, well, rather, our bodies, the weight of our bodies and gravity, you know, and the sensation of making contact with the seat under us or the floor, wherever we're sitting on, that becomes an anchor for us. That anchor, that sensation of the anchor is tending to us, is taking care of us, taking care of us. What does it feel like for this really basic anchor that involves gravity and the body and the seat? What is this? How is this basic anchor taking care of you? What does that feel like? So much of our reconnection to indigeneity is about learning to ask for what we need from the world around us. We can ask for what we need from anything, even from this anchor of the body and the seat. So in my practice, in my mind, in this moment, all I'm doing is asking this anchor to take care of me, to hold me, to support me, to connect me as I move deeper into experiencing these things in my mind and in my body that are really uncomfortable. As I tell the truth about my experience, and what I feel and what I think. Of course, all the shame and the guilt comes up, and the shame and the guilt must also be experienced. It must also be consumed. What is guilt and shame but just a thought? one thought, and then another thought, and then another thought. They're just thoughts. What is shame? What is guilt? There is nothing that can't be consumed, or at least partially consumed, depending on where we're at. Again, relying on the earth, the seat, gravity, the weight of the body. It's also important to remember that we are loved. That we're loved by something as we do this work of consuming. And maybe we say, oh, I don't know who or what that could be. Then that becomes your work, is to understand who and what you're being loved by. And then to connect to that loving. That loving is this energy or this experience of deep acceptance, that this love is just allowing us to be. This love isn't trying to fix us. We're not trying to fix anything. We're trying to notice and allow and experience. Fixing things are just another way that we're attempting to manipulate and dominate things. It's not fix anything, but just let's begin to allow. And in our allowing, we don't have to react. But we can, over time, develop the capacity to respond. To respond. Response can only happen as a result of space that we gain through experiencing. Sometimes I like to sit in these practices and connect to the energy around me, the energy of the season. For me, it's spring, and so connecting to the energy of awakening, the energy of life, right? The energy of today on this land of spring rain, the ways in which this water, this element of water and rain is nourishing the land, replenishing. Can we imagine that this rain is also replenishing us? That this rain is falling from above our heads, and we're getting drenched in this rain, and this rain is maybe not water, but energy of love, of, you know, this energy of compassion, this energy of kindness or wisdom, whatever it may be. What do you need? Whatever you need in this moment, can you ask that energy to meet you? So allow that energy to just actually imagining it just raining from the sky. I just sit and I let this energy, this rain of energy that I need, just drench me. And I allow myself to absorb, to inhale, to drink deeply in from this rain of whatever it is that I'm needing. we say that the world is conscious, we're also saying the world is just energy. And that for me to do really hard work of getting free, I need to learn how to draw from this energy that's naturally present around me. Not drawing and absorbing energy from people around us, right? But drawing energy from the phenomenal world, from the earth, from the elements. It's that energy is there for us to absorb, because we're not absorbing that energy. We're not in this kind of relationship with that energy, you know, where we're just freely drinking in that energy. We're in this relationship that's been about manipulating and dominating and erasing this phenomenal world. But when we change our orientation and we say, oh, I can connect, I can absorb, I can drink deeply from the energy of the phenomenal world, then we start entering into what I would call a sustainable relationship with the phenomenal world. I'm not trying to dominate it. I'm just opening to what the phenomenal world is always trying to offer me. As I deeply drink in this energy, accept this energy, imagine this energy just falling like rain from the sky, whatever it is I need falling from the sky, then it helps me to reduce harm for myself and violence, because I have the energy to do that work. And I become less harmful in the world around me and in my relationships and against myself. Again, maybe thinking about what it is you need. What is the energy that you need? You need the energy of love. You need the energy of kindness. You need the energy of courage, of bravery. You need the energy of audacity. Right? Do you need the energy to be difficult? Right? To be disrupting? Do you need that energy? If you need that energy, just say it out loud. This is what I need. I need the energy of love. I need this energy of love around me. And saying that, moving even further, and just imagine that you're just beginning to breathe in this energy around you. Imagine that your body is beginning to be filled with this energy that you've asked for. But you're not just breathing through your nose or your mouth, but you're breathing and inhaling through every pore opening of the body. As if every like millimeter of skin is inhaling. From your toes, into your toes, into your feet, into your ears, your scalp, into your heart, whatever it may be, every part of your body is inhaling this energy that you've asked for. In my practice, I love to inhale the energy that I need. And as I exhale the energy of gratitude. I'm exhaling gratitude for the phenomenal world around me, for the earth, for the elements, for everything. I'm grateful for everything that's supporting me right now to do this hard work. So breathing in this energy that we need, exhaling the gratitude for having been offered this energy. And this begins to open our heart. It begins to help us to develop more sensitivity to the energy and to the phenomenal world around us. And slowly over time, we feel connected and drawn deeper into relationship with the world. And in this breathing in of energy, you can start creating a container that for many of us we need in order to allow our hearts to break. All the stuff that we're carrying, all the grief, all the worry, all the anxiety, all the hopelessness, all the sorrow that many of us have been not just accumulating since last year, but just for all of our lives, all of this grief, this brokenheartedness, we have to let open. We're asking the phenomenal world around us, this energy to support this breaking of our hearts, so we can begin to experience whatever feels appropriate to experience. Now we're gonna shift a little bit. I want us to turn our attention into where we consider the mind, thoughts, and emotions. Now, I invite you to imagine that the mind itself is just this vast open sky, limitless, boundless, wide open, clear, bright. The clearness, the brightness is just the natural clarity and awareness of the mind. In the sky, there are clouds passing through the sky. These are the clouds of thoughts and emotions. Just letting these clouds of thoughts and emotions just pass through, flow through the sky-like nature of our minds. Just letting them float, not trying to touch them, to embrace them, to change them, just letting them be. Letting this mind be vast and open. Who knows? Begin transitioning out of the practice. And begin by returning our attention back to the seat, noticing the weight of our bodies, the gravity, sensation of making contact with the seat. Allowing that sensation to anchor to ground your attention. And when you're ready, just reawakening the body through simple movements, gentle movements, some stretching, some twisting, whatever feels appropriate for you. Take a few deep, gentle breaths. So, as we move deeper into this period that we're in right now, currently in the world, we have to really develop a lot of trust in our practice. We have to be also beyond that, willing to ask for the help that we need, and asking phenomenal world for that help, for that guidance. Excuse me. And being open to that support, the guidance that we get, the energy that we receive. I am consuming the chaos of the world through the support of sources of refuge. That these sources of refuge are helping me to hold the space. And that space is, again, the space of the mind, space, the space of the world is already there, but we're trying to remind ourselves in our practice that the space is always there if we just notice it, if we can just allow the space to do its work of just being present. When I allow space to be present, then I am guided into experiencing everything. So, we'll shift our attention to any questions that you may have. And again, we can add these questions to the Ask a Question box. And no, don't put it into the chats. But into the box itself so we can all see it. Begin with the first question here. I experience my emotions in my body as well as thoughts. That is when I get caught up in the cloud. How can I work with that? So again, I experience my emotions in my body as well as thought. And that's a natural way of experiencing emotions. The emotions are often seen first as physical sensations and then labeled by the mind. That is when I get caught up in the cloud. How can I work with that? I don't quite understand what you mean by getting caught up in the cloud. But when we get caught up into anything, that means that we've actually kind of started reacting to something. You know, and again, the basic instruction over and over again is how do we allow everything? How do I just notice and just let it be there? And that helps me from getting caught up into anything. You know, it helps me from as we would say, biting the hook. And we get swept up as well because we don't have an anchor that we're relying on. So like having a basic meditation anchor can actually help ground us to keep our attention from actually sweeping, getting swept up into something, but we can just allow our attention to come back to being held by the anchor. Okay. When you're speaking of allowing the earth to hold us, are you speaking of this land with its brokenhearted and poisoned state, as well as the generosity of history, this planet as a whole, the vibration of earthiness that is present on other rocky planets, everything, everything. Let go of thinking a lot too much about what the earth is and just call the earth into the practice. Like the earth element is an element that is not solely uniquely tied to the physical land. The earth element is an element that exists energetically in everything. Our bodies and all phenomenal reality, all phenomenon carry an expression of the earth element. So what we're doing is not just relying on the land, but we're relying on the energy of stability and foundation within all phenomena to hold us, for us to sit on, to grab onto, to hold us. There is trauma and brokenheartedness within the energy, but the energy itself is not brokenheartedness and trauma. It's mixed in there, but it's not it. When we call the earth, we're calling the pure, focused, intentional energy of stability, foundation, groundedness that manifests within all phenomena, including our bodies, including our minds. There's always ground. There's always a base that can be experienced in multiple ways. But again, you don't have to think about that. You can just say, you call the earth, I just want the earth to be present. And whatever I'm going through, I just want to feel stability, groundedness. I want to feel held by something. And then allow yourself to be held. Going to the next question. Shame, especially from childhood trauma, feels like hardest experience to hold and even to use the practice to work with? Any thoughts? Well, I think that the practice actually, and this has to happen over time, and it may happen, this may be something that we're working on for the rest of our lives, but the trauma from how childhood trauma, you know, it is the hardest to hold, but there's so much pain there, and we have to start consuming a piece of it at a time by using the appropriate modalities and supports that we can call in, you know. And to know that, like, the practice, knowing about, like, basic contemplative practice or mindfulness, or even just, you know, our basic meditation practice won't always be enough. Meditation won't be able to tend to everything. And this is why we rely on other modalities of practice, which is why we have so many things, yoga and energy-based practices, is why we have therapies and movement practices, somatic movement practices. This is why we have indigenous plant medicine traditions that we can rely on as well. I mean, there's so many things in the world. And for me, having worked through a lot of childhood trauma, I've relied on so many other things outside of Buddhism and Dharma and mindfulness to help me. And it's proven to be quite liberatory as well. So the practice has helped me, it's led me to other modalities. It's just simply creating an aspiration in my practice, saying that I want to be led into modalities that can help me to support, to move through a lot of intense energy and trauma and so forth, and allow those modalities to find you. So once we open up the intention, the things that we need will start coming. But again, it's something I say all the time. Many of us don't know what we need. And many of us actually have to do a preliminary practice of actually figuring out what it is we need and actually learning how to ask for what we need from the practice and from the world. And it sounds simple, but it's actually really hard to sit and to ask for something. Just to send this aspiration into the space around us. I need energy. I need to work through trauma. I need something that helps me work through grief. This is what I need. And I open to whatever is offered to me to support me. This is all you need to do. And the same with this next question, brokenheartedness. Like, what do I need to support me in my brokenheartedness? For me, you know, at this point in my practice, for me, it's the lived intuitive, it's my lived intuition, or my actual intuition, that the nature of my brokenheartedness is space and emptiness. So it's not so heavy. You know, the brokenheartedness is something that I've learned to give a lot of space to. I've learned how not to self-identify with other people's brokenheartedness, but I say, oh, there's brokenheartedness happening in the space around me. I notice that and see that, but it's not mine. If I try to take it on, then actually I will create more harm, more suffering for myself. That's actually not the way to express compassion. Because it's outside the realm of wisdom. You know, wisdom and compassion must be expressed together. So wisdom says that I need to care for the world, but I also need to care for myself. If I am not caring for myself, I can't care for the world. And we have a hard time with the suffering of the world because we haven't done the work to be in a relationship to our own suffering. Nor have we called in the help to help us to hold space for that, for our own suffering. We feel overwhelmed with the world because we haven't developed that deep practice for ourselves. That I have to begin to see the brokenheartedness of the world as a reflection of my own brokenheartedness. That the world is only pointing back to the work that I need to do to take care of myself. And it's showing me how to ask for the help that I need to be well. I think sometimes we need to do more work with understanding the nature of samsara. Well, the nature of samsara is actually emptiness, but we need to do more work in understanding what samsara is in this moment, you know. That's samsara is an expression of delusion, right? That in the cycle of samsara, everything exists, right? So every bad, possible, worst thing that any person has ever dreamed of and imagined, like a Stephen King, you know, like a Stephen King novel. Like, it's a Stephen, Samsara is a Stephen King novel times 100. When we're contemplating this kind of existence of samsara, it helps us to understand, well, it helps us to develop a deep motivation to get out of here, to liberate. And we liberate ourselves from samsara through the development of wisdom or clarity and compassion or care. Putting wisdom and compassion together, that creates a force that disrupts our experience of samsara. Samsara is always a personal experience that feeds into a collective experience. So not everyone's having the same experience of samsara, but samsara, it's the same thing for everyone. It's still delusion. That we have to develop clarity and care to move out of. And then we learn how to help others develop that same clarity and care that can help them move out of samsara, their expression of samsara, or their experience of samsara. We have to learn to offer, to ask, you know, we can ask the earth to help us hold our brokenheartedness. You know, I have a practice called the Seven Homecomings, which was developed to help us hold the things that we struggle to hold for ourselves by connecting us to this continuous experience of care from benefactors. You know, we feel so overwhelmed because we don't feel connected. We feel isolated. We're not connecting to loved ones. We're not connecting to communities. You have to be connected. Right? You know, I think about indigenous practice, right? I talk about indigenous practice so much because this is what I'm returning to. I'm reclaiming my ancestral practices. And so much of this means that for me, I have to think about help. Like, I need help. I need community. I need sources of refuge. You know, I have to cut through this individualism and return back into a collective mentality. I have to return back into a sustainable mentality that says that I have to rely on everything around me in order to be well. And that everything around me is also relying on me to be well as well. I mean, so many of you take you look at your experience of brokenheartedness is so personal, and it's so isolated, it's so contracting, and of course it's going to be overwhelming. My brokenheartedness is the same brokenheartedness every single being is experiencing in the world. And I am supposed to be brokenhearted. Like, being brokenhearted is not a punishment. This is part of the experience of being human and the relative trying to get free. This is what it means to move through the suffering of samsara, that my heart has to stay broken. Because that's one of the things that's keeping me awake and attuned to people, to beings. And where's your joy, too? Like, if we're so concerned with the brokenheartedness, you also have to be concerned with the joy and the happiness and the fun. What are you doing to experience joy? Because that's going to help to balance and to hold the brokenheartedness. I just can't sit around all day just being completely torn up about the world. Like, there have to be moments of joy for me. I come from an ancestry, a community, a culture of joy in the face of brutal oppression and genocide. Many of you do too. So where's your joy? Our people didn't survive by being brokenhearted 24/7. They survived through family and laughter, you know, and creating arts, you know, through loving. That's how we survive, and that's how we thrive as well. The brokenheartedness is just one part of this. The joy is the other part. It's the joy and the brokenheartedness. One day, maybe I'll write a book about that, joy and brokenheartedness. So next thing, I struggle with, I'm going to try to get through all the questions. I know we only have like 10 minutes, so I'm going to really struggle to get through. I just may have to go through and just kind of look at the... If you vote on the questions and they raise to the top. Okay, great. So we'll do it like that. Anyhow, I struggle with how to transmute, transform, metabolize anger. But it's not just my anger. There's also ancestral anger and collective anger. How do I process anger that is not mine alone? Don't process it. don't transmute it, don't transform it, don't metabolize it. That's too much work. I'm already tired thinking about that. Don't do anything, actually. All you're doing is noticing that anger, and you're allowing that anger to be present, because what's beneath that anger is the brokenheartedness. You know, don't try to do anything for it. You know, it's too much. It's too much initially. I just want to, like, it took me years to get to the point of just, like, naming the anger. Like, naming anger. Oh, that's anger. You know? And then the work began, okay, for me to experience it, you know, I'm just noticing how it's, like, showing up energetically in my body and my mind, as we've just been doing. You know, we're just showing up. I'm not trying to, like, change it. You know, it's just that's not the work that we're doing initially. How do I process that anger that is not mine? Don't process it. If it doesn't belong to you, don't touch it. I mean, I think we get into something when we get wrapped up into something that's really distracting, where we're trying to do all this caretaking for a whole bunch of people. And when in fact, the best way to support the collective is to caretake our own experience of anger. And then we begin to embody an ethic of being in relationship with anger that other people can actually witness and be a part of. And they can begin to do that work for themselves because they see you doing it. That's how we do the collective work. Like, the collective work is first and foremost me asking myself, what is it that I need to do in order to name my anger and to be with a brokenheartedness? I begin to embody that practice, and I move into relationship with others, and other people can see what I'm doing, and then they're invited to do the practice. And that's how we begin to impact a collective change. You have to take a little piece at a time, and this is how we get it. A little piece, you know, like working with our own anger, can actually open the door to this profound way of sharing our practice with the collective. So there's ancestral anger, you know, ancestral anger. Oh, we can get real wrapped up in that, you know? And I just let it pass through my experience. It's like clouds passing through the sky. I just, like, my ancestors are pissed off. There we go. You know? I can feel that. I can also feel the earth under me. I can feel the energy of the space around me. I can feel my other benefactors around me supporting me. I'm also tuned into my brokenheartedness. My brokenheartedness is always there, but it's not distracting for me any longer. It's just an experience that I'm having. And it's an important experience. It's connecting me to the lived experience of so many others around me. We are all brokenhearted, but I do not consent to being consumed by the brokenheartedness. This is what I choose, not to be consumed. I choose to consume the brokenheartedness. I do not consent to be consumed. That's the other piece too that we have to talk about. It's like the ways in which we are all being consumed by something because we have lost connection or relationship to the natural quality experience of space that's always present. When we lose that connection to the space, then we start shrinking, we contract, and then whatever we're moving through consumes us, right? We get consumed by the anger, the fear, the brokenheartedness, the hopelessness, the sorrow, the anxiety, the fear, whatever it may be, we get consumed by it. Instead of opening and saying, oh, my mind is actually spacious and wide, and that this thing, this anger, whatever it may be, is actually just an expression of the space itself. You know? Some of you have practiced the mind ocean work with me. So the mind ocean is that we imagine our minds as a vast ocean. There are waves rising and falling from the ocean. These waves are thoughts and emotions. We call them waves, but they're still water, right? So in the mind, as emotions and thoughts arise out of the mind, they're still the mind, but we're calling them an emotion or a thought. But they're going to return back into the nature of the mind eventually. If we know that, if we understand that, if we have a lived experience of that process, then the realness, the heaviness, the overwhelming nature of the elements of our mind diminishes some. It only has to diminish a little bit, you know, for us to experience this intense space. That diminishing reminds us of the space. So for the last few months, whenever I try to sit and meditate, I find that I'm very sleepy. Even with heavily guided meditations, I'm drifting away. It feels like an obstruction that I can't get past. I don't know how to relate to it differently. How can I work with this experience? Well, it could be many things. I guess the first thing that I want to say, that could be trauma. It could be a trauma response. That fatigue could be actually a mechanism of trauma, which is, I say that, I want to say that because that's many of us, and I used to be someone like this as well, so I speak from experience. I used to be someone who didn't understand trauma, who didn't get trauma. I used to believe that I didn't have trauma, right? And this was going on, I mean, literally into my 30s, where I realized, oh, like I am experiencing trauma. And then this is where I began to learn and take classes and, and do all the reading and everything. But, and so I developed a language around trauma. And so I began to understand how trauma manifests for us in so many different ways. So I think this past year for many of us, not, of course, I say, so for some of us, our whole lives have been really so much a struggle, but definitely in this past year and all the work, and the things that we've gone through in this pandemic has created a level of trauma that I think many of us are not connecting to. With the trauma also comes a lot of vicarious, well, it comes a lot of ambiguous grief. And it's hard, ambiguous grief is hard to name in our experience, because we can't pinpoint what we're grieving, but we know that there's grief. I think all of this is a part of impacting our meditation practice. Of course, there's so many different methods that we can use to support sleepiness fatigue. We have, particularly in insight tradition, we have lots of methods. I think another really common sense thing too is maybe we're just tired. That is actually, yeah, it can actually be trauma, but it can also be the fact that we're not resting enough as well. So when we sit and practice, like we're just really tired, and I know that to be the case for many of us as well. Like some we just I too I go through periods of just really, really being really exhausted and not sleeping well, and picking up on things happening around me in the world is hard. It becomes really difficult to work with. I think just looking at the ways in which we're trying to experience rest, one of the main practices that I use with fatigue, if I'm experiencing that, is just actually using the fatigue, the tiredness as an anchor or an object of my meditation. So you're actually just using it as an anchor. And so therefore we bring a kind of awareness to the experience of fatigue and the practice that can actually add a lot of energy. And we begin to explore the ways in which we react to fatigue. And also, shortening maybe our practice, moving maybe into other kinds of meditation practice, maybe movement practice can be helpful, walking practice, a kind of a yoga practice could be helpful as well. Sometimes just doing a sitting practice isn't that helpful for some of us. So let me. Oh, consuming experience. So I'll just answer this quick question here. Inspire a bit more about what you mean by consuming experience. Yeah, consuming experience, again, it means that I experience. It means that I think I just answered it anyway. It's when I allow the space to be present around everything that's arising in my experience, that is me consuming the experience. I am being consumed when I contract and shut down and let the experience itself overwhelm me. We feel overwhelmed when we've lost connection to space, to fluidity, to movement. And we say, oh God, this is too much. And when you find yourself saying, oh, this is too much, then you know that you need to call in something into your practice. You need to do something different. When I find myself saying that, then I know that I need to do something different. Like I need to take a break. I need to do something that sparks joy for me. I need to rest, right? I need to do practice, whatever it may be. I need to do something else because that sense of overwhelming, being overwhelmed, is not conducive to how I know my mind and experience is. My mind and experience is space, or spacious. When I am overwhelmed, I've lost connection to that truth. Okay, so we're gonna kind of end our time there. So thank you everyone so much for tuning in. And yes, please stay connected to me, to teachings, my website, lamarad.com. I have all of my programs listed there. And I have hopefully a program on grief and grieving, brokenheartedness coming up later, hopefully at the beginning of the summer. Please stay connected to that. You can join my email list to stay connected to those announcements. And maybe another course on love and rage at the end of the year, but I'm not for sure yet. Okay. Thank you all so much for being here and for your practice. Melanie, do you need to come up again? Okay. Okay, great. All right, so that's it. Thank you all so much. And please be well. I want to do a dedication. I dedicate the merit of our session today, of our practice, the liberation of all beings, that we all may have what we need in order to experience freedom. Thank you all so much.